So 2 weeks ago I spoke about the question of whether Gracious is about philosophy. The way we broke down the question was whether we could establish that there was at least one story in Gracious that could be read most plausibly as being interested in the kind of question that abstract philosophers are interested in. And we ended up arguing was that the story of the Tower of Babel is read most plausibly as being about the question of the origin of language and the relationship on the nature of the relationship between language and reality, which is the kind of question that generally comes up only in people are concerned with philosophy for its own sake, with abstract knowledge for its own sake, and therefore it was plausible to argue that Gracious is about philosophy. This week's title is Gracious Literature. So let's try and talk about what that question means. There is a literal sense in which literature is stuff that's written. Gracious is written. Right? It's in a book. Right, so we can answer the question, is Gracious literature? Of course. Right, Gracious is written, in a book, of course Gracious is about literature. So we have to have a somewhat more specific meaning for literature. And the reason that people resist, saying that Gracious is literature, is because people think of literature as fiction. Right, so you have to be very careful to say, right, obviously, literature contains both fiction and nonfiction, but there's still an important point in that. You got it? Okay. So the mashal that I like to give students about the necessary relationship between language and reality when you're constructing a narrative. So the exercise I tend to give my students is to ask them to write a comprehensive essay about a square inch of ceiling tile. And a totally comprehensive essay. So they have to begin just by explaining what color ceiling tile is. And that turns out to be an extraordinarily complicated question. Because ceiling tile actually, it appears to us a certain way, but actually the color appears to us in the combination of lots of little things of different colors. And then we just try and move on to the colors and the composition of it. You have to write, are you describing it at the subatomic level, the atomic level, the molecular level, the gross level? And it turns out that you can write and really genuinely to describe a quarter inch of ceiling tile requires books and books and books. If you wanted to go to the whole wall, right, you start becoming infinite. And what that means is that any time you reduce reality to language, you have the same phenomenon as any time you reduce reality to easy to imagine in the visual screen, right? The visual screen, you have only a certain number of pixels. Therefore, in reality, right, reality comes down to the infinitely small point, but there's a limit to how much you can shrink pixels. You're always going to have to engage in overgeneralization, and you're going to eliminate some of the details when you digitize reality. Furthermore, there are going to be places in which you can create a closer perception of reality by actually deliberately altering things from the way they are. And this is part of the principle of creating backdrops for theater. That a perfect literalist image works poorly as backdrop. You want to convey to people a certain image, you have to paint backdrops in a certain kind of abstract way, which is not actually true to the form. Because if you paint it that way, people will actually be more likely to have the illusion that something is actually there. So, as that mashal, so when God chooses to reduce reality to language, then there are going to be choices made. And those choices are going to be in that order, right? So you have to decide what the pixel size is and how big the book is going to be, right? That's fundamentally the same question. And in there may be times when you have to describe things somewhat differently than they actually are in order to convey them. So that's a fundamental saying that the Bible's literature may have a complicated point, right, that which Chazal possibly expressed with the phrase Yigat Terak Lashon Beda. The Torah is spoken in human language, and human language is limited that way. Right? It has long enough, it can only go to a certain scale, and it has to adapt to human perceptions. So I'll put that up front, that the boundaries for literature as the attempt to convey reality in words always involves choices which may require viewing from literalism, and it's worth thinking about how one deals with it theologically in the context of Torah. But there is a second notion of literature which is that literature, at least the way we use it conventionally, literature is a use of language which is interested in form for its own sake. Literature is the use of language which is interested not just in what in conveying what the language refers to, but is interested in the way in which you convey that reality in language. So do we think that there's a theologian named, by a Jewish theologian named Byron Sherwin, who has an essay on the model, which he describes as Portrait of God as a Young Artist. Now there are all sorts of theological challenges to that particular issue, but it raises the question of whether we're entitled to think that God is interested in art such that he is concerned with making gracious formally beautiful, or formally precise. Now this issue, I have to say that I have a lot of theological interest in, whether beauty per se is one of the values that God wishes to convey. It seems to be a plausible argument can be made that if we think the world is beautiful and God looked at the Torah and created the world, then there must be beauty in Torah as well as in the world, and you can make a theological argument for beauty that way. There is not at this point a really well-developed Jewish theological argument for beauty. Rav Chaim Bravender, in a wonderful essay in the book Wisdom from All My Teachers, began to develop such an idea. My favorite example of it is the Gemara in Bava Metzia, which says, in order to understand the beauty of Rabbi Yochanan, you have to do the following thing. You have to take a new silver goblet, I believe it is, and fill it with pomegranate seeds and hold it up to the sun at a particular angle and look at the color of light that is shed on the wall. Now, whatever that means, it sounds like the Gemara is interested in beauty. And I think there's certain colors, right? If they're are really beautiful, it seems to me that something could be done with that Gemara that would enable us to develop a rabbinic conception of beauty. But whether one is willing to say that there are things in Chumash that are there among other purposes at least, perhaps not exclusively, but at least among other purposes for the sake of literary beauty is an open question. I want to just present to you a couple of Rishonim on that subject, and then we're going to go to straight Gemara. So we take a look at first number one. So Rashi and Roshi starts back to Tutsuk Gimel. I should just say, those of you who are not comfortable reading Chumash in Hebrew might be well advised to take in English. Regrettably, there's so many sources here, I didn't have a chance to do an English translation, so you might want to pass that English Hebrew Chumash in and extract the bridge. Want to do that just so we make sure everyone has one? Meanwhile, Michael, you have a question? Oh, good. Oh, you have a question, yes.
Does
it make
you feel like
aesthetic
sense or like Hebrew moral?
I'm raising that possibility. I'm saying that I don't think there is enough. I'm not the first person to lament the absence of a Jewish theology of beauty. And I think Rabbi Bavender began addressing that in a very interesting way in the Wisdom for All My Teachers. There are a couple other attempts. I suspect that Michael Wishergrad has a piece somewhere. I don't remember precisely where. I've seen a couple others. But Edmund done well, this is where I start from in that conception. And if it seems to me you can make the argument I made that if there's beauty in the world, and we think that we should appreciate the beauty of the world, and we take the position that the Torah and the world are a one-to-one correspondence, and the Torah is a blueprint, and there should be beauty in Torah as well. And those are two ways, one theological biblical way, and one rabbinic way in which I think you can develop an argument for beauty. But I'm not saying it's a positive, I'm just raising that question. And see, it turns out that God is interested in beauty as such, it is possible that God is simply interested in writing a really good book. It's possible. But it's a theologically radical statement, so I want to tell you the truth. I thought I got this from Michael. Which Adam Beach says about Chava, the ability to carry Isha, came Ish Lukapoto. And Rashi says, Lashon Nafel al Lashon, right? So the word Isha falls upon the word Ish. And Rashi probably that that's deliberate. But here he derives a sort of philosophic lesson as opposed to saying that God is interested in tongues. He says, Mikan Shibra Olam Lashon HaKadosh. And here he derives that the world was created in Lashon HaKodesh. So maybe God put in a tongue, which is not necessarily meaningful, maybe it is, just to tell you that since the pun only works, and that she tells you, since the pun only works in Lashon HaKodesh, therefore, right, that the first man must have spoken Lashon HaKodesh. Okay, but in Rashi's parak, Gimel Pasuk Ted Vav, right, in which in God's punishment of Chava, regarding the state, it says, Rashi says, "Who Yishukar Rosh means that he will cut me down. He will cut you down right from the head. Vatatu Shupena Vakev, and you will crush, right, and you will crush him." But Rashi says that really the first word, Yishukha, comes from a word meaning to cut into pieces. And the second word, Kishupeno, comes from a word meaning to hit. Because the snake hisses before it bites you. So it's actually claimed that there's no etymological relationship. Unlike Isha and Ish, right, where Lashon HaFel Lashon is there probably to tell you the relationship that Isha means taken from Ish, when it comes to Yishukha and Kishupeno, right, that although they sound alike, it actually tells you there's no etymological relationship. But he says, well, the fish of HaLashon, the fish of HaLashon, Katav Lashon HaShikav Mishmeyam. But because it's a good pun, right, it used the sound of Shikav for both of them. So that sounds like Rashi believes that there are meaningless puns in Rashi and Tanash. And it's tough to figure out why there are meaningless puns unless God is interested either in Judy, although we'll make one of the possibilities that yes,
does. I was just wondering, so it seems like you're trying to combine the two Rashi's and the absence of the fact that the fact that one doesn't say that the purpose the world was created in Lashon HaKodesh. But I'm wondering if Rashi is aware of the fact, I don't know if the pun exists in languages that Rashi had access to, but the pun does work in English for the first part. And I don't know if it works in French or not.
Yeah, that's a weakness. I'm not interested in evaluating Rashi's claims. I want it to be open that using the language Lashon Nafel Lashon isn't the claim that it's just a pun. That's what the first example is there for. But whether Rashi's right or not, whether he's right about the other purpose, I can tell many other purposes were puns.
He could be saying at that point, he might be simply saying that this is only particularly in Hebrew, not that it's, I don't know if you can prove that
in
the fact he doesn't
say
the
letter point. I think the letter point he tells you, there are only two to prove it. Right, you don't need one pun will prove to the world was created in Hebrew, and you don't need a second one. I think he tells you pretty straightforwardly, right? But the only reason for this is the only reason for this. I think there it's Lashon HaFel Lashon itself, right? Because it's obvious in context that it matters that Isha and Isha are related, right? Right here, it's obvious that it doesn't matter, and Rashi says the only reason to do it was to show, right, was for the pun. I think. Abiedra. Alternate Ezra says in one place Yishmael Shmaticha. He says that's the Derek Sapus. That's just good style. Yishmael Shmaticha. And he gives another example of Kimar or Titar Ver. And another topic says Nachash Arum, meaning it was clever. Achar Arumim follows and the two of them and Damas Kaga were naked. Not because there is a connection philosophic or mystical between nakedness and cleverness, which most people argue, and they just said, Lashon Tafus. This is good style. Kimot, Kiev Erish, Gacharat Hamavir. Okay, which, right, where it means different things. They also quote, Tuot Sukim, Balechi Achamor, which is called the Kamor Kamor Achayim. Right, in other words, that authors in Tanakh, divine or human, like writing in good style, and good style means that you would make plays on words. I come to the exchange there, and good style means plays on words. So it seems to me that the position, at least of these two great Pashtunim, Rashi and Ezra, is that God is interested in style for his own sake. On that order, you can then take a look at sources 3 and 4, which are fun examples of other types of puns that may not be profound. And by the we reverse the letters. Rishon will give you other examples where it seems that Sarah is just playing with language. And I myself am theologically ambivalent about this, but I think we should establish that the Rishonim weren't. I'm much familiar there. The ultimate explanation is that God is not interested in style for its own sake, but that since God is writing in human language, so the Torah, the written human language, has an interest in sustaining our interest. And so it, right, and so any author speaking to communicate to human beings is well advised to write well, because a good book is more likely to absorb, to hold people's interest and to ensure their obedience than a bad book. Now I should say, I also just said the thesis that seems historically untrue in the case of the Jews, based on, this is just based on a comparative reading of the literary prophets, Yeshaya, Yirmiyahu, and Yechezkel, with ancient Near Eastern pagan literature, which honestly is awful. And one of the great mysteries to me is how it is that paganism had any attraction to Jews, considering how much better our poetry was than theirs. It seems to be plausible that a well-written book will have, right, will have more popular appeal than a badly written book. So what I can tell is whether true in the ancient Near East, at least in the late First Temple period. Now that may be a function of translation, or it may be, as they argue in a different shir, that Chazal killed the Tahara for Avodah Zarah, as the shir they're running on the lawn, Chazal killed the impulse for idolatry and limits the capacity to appreciate idolatrous poetry. So if we were still into the pagan impulse that I described as the desire to unify, unify sex, violence, and religion, it may be that in that ecstatic urge, then poetry that currently seems utterly, deathly, hopelessly dull, would in fact seem entirely such. I believe that is a possibility. Okay, however, if it is, if it is the case, right, yes?
Is it possible
that the use of that language is wrong because
for the purpose of
narration,
or is it something other than
actual reading the language?
Is it
memorable? There is enough of it. That Torah doctrine, the written text, has an interest in being memorized. That's a pretty strong position to me. This is a tangent, but I like making this argument. Last week I quoted one of Evan Goodman's arguments that the divinity of Torah, because the name just gave up the ancient roots of the philosophic concept of God that is utterly out of cultural context in the ancient Near East. To me, one of the best truths of God that I know of, I wouldn't stake my faith on it, but it's not a bad thing to go back to for me, if it turns out to be true, is that God invented prose. There's no narrative prose anywhere in the ancient Near East, the corporation. And one of the differences between poetry and prose is that poetry is memorized, and prose is written. So I would have a hard time making the argument that way, because poetry in ancient Near East is all parallelistic, which uses memorization. Okay, so now a second phenomenon, if we take the interest perspective, is suspense. So is Bereshit literature in the sense that it withholds information not because it is important for us not to know this information now for a substantive reason, but rather because it helps, right, because that makes us read on, right, so that we find out what happens. So one interesting possible example of the use of suspense is found in verse number 5, which is Gracious Perikis says, Wicked Lam and Zek and Lam Yigel, when at the end of the dialogue between Avraham and Sodom, it says, Vayomer, Omer, Yisrael was annoyed by the Brah, the problem was not, let Hashem not be angry, I will speak even this time, maybe there will be 10 people lying in the Tumshan Asara, and Hashem says, Vol Ashtit Bavur Asara, I will not destroy for the sake of those 10, and then God leaves and he finished speaking to Avraham, and Avraham goes back to his place, and you don't know what happens. And then we have the whole cover, and it takes you a while yet to find out what happened, and that may be just an example of a cliffhanger. Right, where you really, you finish the dialogue, right, and it's often actually very useful to think of Chumash in cinematic terms, right, or, right, so you know that, right, the camera, there's a camera focus, whatever that would mean, on God, right, on Avraham and God, and all of a sudden the camera draws back, and you see the city of Sodom. And now you try and find out, right, well, what did God actually, when God said, well, let's keep the horror off the rod, was that an anticlimax because there aren't 10 people there? Or we say, yay, Avraham won. Okay, so that's an example which that's an example of a suspense, which you can argue is we always have to ask whether suspense is substantive and that it changes the way in which you understand the story, or it's just there because it was time for a commercial. And we want you to tune in again after the advertisement's been inserted. Okay. Now, so let's talk about other. So we talked about so far are whether Stella is interested in literature because it's interested in aesthetic, right, in the aesthetic beauty of language. But I think really that question is generally less important than the following question. Whether the types of questions that we use nowadays to interrogate and interpret works of literature enhance our understanding of Chumash. Right, so the question, literature is a construct. Right? Everything in words is a construct. Right? Everything in words is literature. And we choose to set up certain categories that it describes this as biography and that, right, and that as travelogue and that, right? These are all, right, and then we say, oh, well, based on the genre, we have certain expectations. So the question is whether the types of questions that modern readers use, some of which are ancient and some of which are distinctively modern, used to interrogate written texts, are likely to enhance our understanding of Chumash. I'm recognizing that as an all original interpretation, we always have to figure out how new techniques can enable you to come up with new interpretations, but at the same time enable one to be a genuine continuation of tradition. Right? That's always a tension in all forms of interpretation that are not a strict repetition of an authority. And here I should just say by autobiographically that really like one of the most exciting moments in my life was when I took a course in biblical narrative with Professor Moshe Bernstein in the Rebbe Graduate School at Yeshiva, and we basically discussed these issues, and we ran across a book by Professor Meir Sternberg called The Place of Biblical Narrative, which just utterly transformed my appreciation of Tanakh by using these kind of techniques and making Chumash just open up to me in a way I'd never considered. So I certainly have a bias towards those kinds of questions. Yes, Abby.
Right, so just to be clear, your thesis is not that
it's just a case study. It doesn't bias you one way or the other about that other book. Okay, so let's take a. So we'll start with the work that we looked at last week, the section which is Migdal Bavel. So I want to talk about two other techniques here. One is, if you look at the underlined section in the middle, it says, right, so the people say, let's build a city, they're not under shame, and we'll make ourselves a name, and the sons of Nathal are, lest we be scattered through the land. And the other story is, therefore, his name is Babel. Right, because their God confused the languages, and therefore scattered them all over the land. Now, we talked about last time, though, the word shum, right, the fun of, right, not so under shame, or came for a shema, by Yachad Hashem Otam Misham, but this seems like a very straightforward use of what we call irony. Right? They said that, let us make ourselves a name so we will not be scattered, and therefore they got a name, right, which was a memento of their being scattered. And if you then look at it, you'll see, and much of this I owe to the Dutch interpreter Jason Toppelman, who has he tends to see what we call theistic structures everywhere, and sometimes it's true. And the Migdal Bavel is utterly convincing. And the rest of almost every other example I find forth, but the Migdal Bavel is utterly stunning as an example of that. But you see, right, so the Migdal Bavel uses two. One is that I think it's, you can see the irony, they say Hava, Hashem says Hava. And you can use the formal structure that there's, but at the end of the first minute is the Nathal and Hashem saying the post, the end of the story is saying the post. The beginning is by Hicholar, Sephalchat. The end is Baal Hashem, Sephalchat. And you have all these basic structural techniques that are the kinds of questions that we formally ask now, I think sensitive readers were always aware of them, but tended not to ask the question precisely that way, whereas contemporary readers will always say, okay, what's the structure? Because there's an influence there structurally. I think Miguel Lovell shows this example really clearly. It also shows another kind of technique, which is, I think, really useful, which you can find, I think, the best illustration of a contemporary reader using this is, I think, the Zornberg in her chapter on Bridges, which is talking about looking at the physical axis along which the action takes place. So you have to, like, Miguel Lovell, what is the first thing they do is they go down into a valley, right, so they sink themselves down, or they find a Degas, and they say, well, we're in a valley, let's go all the way up to God from the bright. We chose to put ourselves in a valley, surrounded by mountains, right? Because the valley, right, is a valley of mountains, right? So we went to the lowest place we could go, and from the lowest place we can go, we're going to go all the way up, we're going to build a tower with its head in heaven, and so you start down here, and you go all the way up, and what's the climax? And God came down, right, to see. Right, so that kind of analysis, right? And now God comes down, he says, and then he says, oh, let's go down further. Right, so the physical axis shows you the disparity between their ambitions and their ambitions and reality. And that again is an axis which I think you can the kind of axis that, of course, Mitrash is aware of, but we would tend to look at it systematically now. And again, if you look at even Zornberg's essay on Bridges, you'll see that is played out just beautifully over and over again. Yes.
How does that make the story any different than the story of the letter?
How does that make the, if you see spiders and metaphors, they're the same thing, yes.
Okay.
That's the problem, you can include metaphors, sophisticated metaphors, you're right. So this is just the spiders, I'm going to go down first.
Okay.
Right. Okay. So we talked about, puns, suspense, irony, and structure. Let's now go on to, let's look at the story of Joseph. Okay, so if you look at verse 7, the story of Yosef, one thing it gives you, and again, this is cinematically explored, the use of perspective. So it tells you, Yosef goes off to see his brothers, he tells his father Hineni, which is, we'll talk about that later, and his father tells him, go see what your brothers are doing, and he goes, right, so his father sends him, and he comes to Shem, and a man finds him, he's in the field, the man asks him, what are you looking for? He says, I'm looking for my brothers. The man says, mysterious thought going on. Yosef goes after his brothers, and he finds them in Dothan. Right? So you have to imagine, that the camera is behind Yosef. And he goes after his brothers, and he finds them in Dothan, and they see him from the distance. So the camera literally shifts, It's all set at a sudden camera angle. You shift from the center field camera to the camera behind home plate, and now you're looking through the brother's eyes and not through Yosef's eyes. Up until that moment, the moment he finds them, we're looking through Yosef's eyes, but as soon as they meet, Yosef loses the capacity to control the action. And for the rest of the story, everything takes place from behind the brothers, and Yosef is the object of the camera, not the subject. So that's again the example, where it's often valuable to think in Chumash, whose perspective the story is being told from. The cooler aspect, and this I guess from Sternberg in the Yosef story, is what is Yosef doing while the brothers are doing this to him? So in the narrative it says the brothers, they see him and they plan to kill him, they have a whole dialogue on themselves, Reuben is saved now. So when Yosef comes to his brother, and now here, again, be careful, we've been having a dialogue among the brothers up till now, now we shift away from the dialogue, and we switch the narrative. Question, why is it that, we're starting to shift from talking about what's going on inside the brother's head, from an intentional direction? They take off Yosef's ketonet, the ketonet hakim rishadanim, they take him, they throw him into the pit, and the pit is empty, there's no water in it, and they sit down to eat, and they see the Ishmaelim, and they have a whole dialogue, they tell the Ishmaelim and all that. In this entire episode, what is Yosef doing? Nothing. We have no idea what Yosef is doing in this story. But five chapters later, source number 8, the brothers are correct. The brothers are being are dealing with their certain accusation of being spies, of being spies and thieves in Egypt, and they say to each other, "Aval Hashanim Anachnu Malachim," but we are guilty about our brother. But he kind of know Elena Velo Shemana when he begged us, and we didn't listen. Whoa! Who said the guilty was begging? Why wasn't that there in the original story? Okay, this is an example we call delayed information. Right? It seems that Torah is choosing to give you the information, to not tell you the information about what Yosef is doing. Whenever he just cuts in and doesn't tell us what the brothers hear about the brother, doesn't know what the Yosef is doing, just tells us what they're doing, and it waits till 5 chapters later. Which is an interesting question is why. Sternberg's theory, which I think is highly plausible, is that in chapter 37, you know that the brothers are the bad guys, and Yosef is the innocent victim. It's pretty clear they're the bad guys, and they're doing bad things to Yosef. 5 chapters later, Yosef has been mean to his brothers for quite some time. Right, he's made false accusations against them, he's sent them back and forth, he's being mean to his father by making them bring Benjamin down, and he starts to wonder, you know what, maybe he deserves it. Right? That's a good time to say, you know, to point out, no, these brothers are really bad guys and they deserve what he's doing to them. Because, look, their brother was begging them. And, right, and they didn't listen. Right? So, Sternberg argues that information is rationed in biblical narrative to make sure that your sympathies are in the right place when reading. Okay, and that's also very thing. He treats this as a technique that you've also been offered to give you the example in the example here. Okay. Another technique which is important, and this is something that is often missed by various filmmakers, is recognition of the difference in perspective. That we have here now is recognizing that the narrator sometimes denies us information. Next issue is recognizing the distinction in perspective between the narrator and the characters. So if you take a look at source number 9, so Avraham wakes up in the morning, Avraham wakes up in the morning and goes back to the place where he stood before the face of God, and he overlooks the stone of Marah and the whole land of the plain, and he sees that behold the plume of the land rises like the plume of an oven, and camera looking to Avram's eyes. Camera shift, panoramic perspective. Avram is now in the camera. Avram is now just now looking in the camera. And it was. And the structure, when God destroyed the cities of Kikar, the God remembered Avram and he sent Lot out from the overturning which he had overturned. Right, the key point here is that Avraham does not know this. Right, we know. Right, we know that in the destruction of Lot, the destruction of Sodom, that Lot was saved. But all Avram knows is that he argued with God last night. We've been waiting to find out what happened. We found out what happened now. Right, we have an entire narrative in which Lot is unable to escape, and then the cities are destroyed. But all that was right. All that, remember, that's our perspective. Right, Avram is asleep while all this happens. Avram wakes up. And all he sees at the end of the story, we know more than he does. Okay, and that manipulation of perspective is very important. Now, here we get into the issue of Chatzitzmasoret. The classic Midrashic reading is that when you get to the Akedah, that the two Ne'arim with Avraham are Lot and Yishmael. Because they're the characters who are in Avram's life who are missing. Yishmael was sent away, and Lot was sent away, and so they show up there, and because of what is called the principle, the Hanuman principle, the conservation of personalities in the Midrash, right? So the Ne'arim has to be somebody, so let's make them Lot and Yishmael. So I want to suggest that based on this theme, which seems to me designed deliberately to convey to you that Avraham does not know that Lot survived, a very different reading of the Akedah, in which you have to recognize the fundamental question of the Akedah has to be, what does Avraham think right? Is this a shock sadhana? Word is out, right? And therefore, Avram is just wandering along in stunned, right? In stunned, you know, stunned indecision, or in some kind of really fancy Kierkegaardian, dialectical faith, or whatever it may be. Now, the issue with that reading, which has a lot of attraction, perhaps, in the Akedah as a standalone story, is that it doesn't really put it in the context of Abraham's life. This is the point we'll return to later, but I just want to set up very briefly a theme of Abraham's life, which we'll come back to in a few sources, which is that we have two episodes in the previous Akedah in which Abraham argues with God and argues that a punishment that God wishes him to inflict on somebody is a bad idea. We have stone, where Abraham tries to intervene in a divine plan, which has the consequence, so far as he thinks, of ending in the death of his nephew Lot. And Abraham loses the argument. Then Abraham is told to send away Ishmael, and he argues, and God says that no. Everything that Sarah says you have to do. So if you assume that Lot was originally in Avram's mind, Avram assumed that since he was childless, Lot would be his heir. So he lost his first son, Kasokad Bincha. Then he actually has a son, Ishmael. And he was a bad son, Bincha. So then the Akedah, right, is just part of the progression. In which first you're supposed to allow someone to die, and you try to intervene and you lose. Then you're told to send someone else to die, and you try to argue and you lose, and finally you're told to kill. Right, so I think that at least this powerful way of reading the Akedah, although again I should say that this is against that midrash, is that Abraham, at the moment of the Akedah, Dafka does not know that Lot and Ishmael have survived. And that emerges, I think, from the very careful rationing of information in the story where we, at the end of the dialogue, we very explicitly cut away and say, and this is what's happening off screen for Avram, and then we go out of our way to say, and when Avram woke up, this had already happened. And so Avram has no way of knowing that. Okay, we'll come back to the Akedah in a few minutes. Other techniques that, literary categories that will influence the way in which we understand Chumash. We take a look at source number 10. The source of 10 is the verse, Vayevaseya Kobo Vado, Vayevesh Yishimo Ado Rashachar. What does this mean? So here, I guess I will indulge myself in a insufficiently reverent tirade about the attraction to the French Pasha, you know, among some people. As much as honorific education seems to believe that the proper way to teach, you know, is really just to teach the French Pasha, you know, specifically Rashbam. So I have to say that I really don't like Rashbam. Shot here, I'm going to go to the next class. But Rashbam says that what happened here is that, well, why did the angel come to us with Yaakov? Because Esau was coming and Yaakov was scared, couldn't run away. It would have been a philosophy after going away, so it looked like he was there, if he was. So, Rezumal came and was there to make sure the Yaakov could run away. Now, look, it was too late to run away, so the Malach was. Okay, this to me, the only way I can describe this is you have this really rich, nice, juicy text, and there are some comes with a very heavy sledgehammer and goes, wham! And just take the text and slashes it. So that nothing, no meaning whatsoever is left inside it. I absolutely can't stand this reading. This is usually my great example of why one should not see that particular kind of reading as the meaning of the text. Now, I think Nachama Leibowitz argued to my mind really compellingly, and this I think is shot in the measures that Rashi cites, is that the purpose of this text is to set up the paradox of Yaakov is left alone and man wrestles with him. Huh? And therefore, Nechama Leibowitz argued that obviously the point is that the wrestling match has to take place inside Yaakov. That, she argues, I think it's right, that when Rashi cites the Midrash that Yaakov is wrestling with the angel of Esav, what it really means is that Yaakov is having a wrestling match with the aspect of Esav inside him. This is really beautifully developed again by David Zornberg, and this I think is really probably like the most powerful passage in the book on Bereshit, in which I think is really worth meditating all in the general context of theater, where she says that if you're a good actor, then, and particularly if when you take a role, right, and you're a method actor, you really become that, and it's very hard ever to shake that off. And Yaakov put on Esav's clothing and acted like Esav and didn't feel alien and spends at least until this point wondering why it was that he could fool himself. Why wasn't it obvious that he wasn't right? But if you can put on a pretense and make people think that you're Esav, then obviously there has to be something about you that fits with Esav. And so this is the moment. Right? So this is the moment. And of course, if Yaakov and Esav are not distinguishable, then taking the Bechorah was meaningless. And what's the point, right? If Yaakov and Esav are really the same people, right? So, all right, so everything that Yaakov, right, so ironically, the success of the masquerade challenges Yaakov very deeply, because he has to wonder, in a sense, right, like the Groucho Marx joke, right, I wouldn't want to join any club that would have me. Right, Yaakov shouldn't be able to pull off any masquerade, right, shouldn't want to have anything that he can get by masquerade. So I think Ezra Zornberg correctly argues that this is, right, that the Chalulah is correctly giving shot in the Midrash that Rashi thinks. I don't think it's Rashi to understand the Midrash that Chalulah, I think it's shot in the Midrash. But this notion that you would set up an internal struggle, not by saying that Yaakov wrestled inside himself, but by setting up this, saying he's alone and yet stays right, and having you figure out if he's alone and he's wrestling with a man, then that man must come from inside him, makes a lot more sense if you are aware of a literary technique called surrealism, right, which tries Dafka to, right, to not make it explicit that you're dealing with a dream, right, but to blur the line, right, to make the psychological appear real, right. So I think this reading, right, which, right, if you understand that the technique of surrealism is to blur the question, right, so let's say the distinction between the book The Wizard of Oz and the movie. Right, in the movie The Wizard of Oz, right, you play dream music. Right, when Dorothy gets blown up on the cycle, all of a sudden and now you see, in the movie, that the entire scene of Oz is a dream, and we know where Dorothy wakes up. In the book, it never says that. In the book, you're supposed to be left wondering whether this is real or not. So if you know that there's a technique which Dafka tries not to disambiguate whether you're talking about reality or internal reality, then the Chalulah is reading makes sense. If you're not aware of that technique, then it's much harder to read Chumash Torah. Okay. Next technique. This is now we're in the story of Akedah, which is source number 12. This is the one that Martin Buber made famous. The Leitmotif. Which, for those who are often above, apparently the example of that is the trumpet thought when the dragon comes in the ring cycle in Wagner. Not having really ever having listened to it, I couldn't tell you anything about it. I just thought that's the example that tells me it's my story. That's where we got it from. So the way that plays out is so much, and I believe it's Blooper stepping up, is that there are certain words that recur. And those recurrent words often carry the themes of books. So if you look at the Akedah, where it says 11 and 12 together, if you notice that the separations begins, the story of Avram begins, the Yomar Shem El Avram left the Kham, Eric the Kham, Eric the Kham, Eric the Kham, Eric the and the Akedah, right, God says to him, Kachnap inside, you scratch your up, you scratch the left the Kham, Eric the Moriah. And that tells you, right, that tells you that this story is the climax of the original epoch. This is where it all comes true. Now, you can interpret that thematically as you will. I would make the broader argument along the lines I made earlier that actually one of the tensions in Avram's life is that he is commanded to leave his family. Your culture and your family. But he takes Lot because he can't actually leave his family. He takes his family with him, and we can do a much more sophisticated analysis of whether he takes him or Lot comes and he doesn't turn him away. Right? All sorts of beautiful things about that. And so therefore, the replica is not fulfilled until the moment when Avram actually has to choose between family and God. And it's exactly that in which he makes the choice and then is told that he never should have to. So certainly Lech Lecha becomes Olam Mancham, a leading word to police, leading word to apparition in that way. The other word which plays out in this narrative is the expression the term Hinni, which shows up with important that Avram says he needs to God, he needs to Yitzchak, and he needs to the Malach. And I think there's important thematic consequences that Avram reacts all of them the same way, especially he reacts to Yitzchak the same way he relates to the others. And of course the phrase Vayochu Yachdav, which if you read it closely, you discover that when the Akidah starts, Avram is Narim and Yitzchak are all separate. He takes his Ne'arim and lastly he takes Yitzchak with him and he gets up and he goes. Right? So at being the Akedah, then the only actor here is Avraham. And they're not going together, he is taking them with him. But then you have the dialogue between Yitzchak and Avraham. Which I set up this way because I think that there's a compelling reading when you say the Yomer Yitzchak of Avraham Avi is by Yomer. So why does that say the Yomer twice? It's that I think the reading that here Yitzchak is trying to say something, but he can't bring himself to say it. Right? So first Yitzchak looks at Avraham and says he can't say anything, and then he says, "Father." Right, and Avraham says, he identifies himself as father. And then Yitzchak asks as indirectly as he can, now Yitzchak knows perfectly well that in every culture surrounding him, the ultimate service to God is the sacrifice of your only son. So he knows perfectly well what life is on. And Avraham answered, that God will decide who the Sayyid Allah is, and then you have Vayochu Shehem Yachdav. At that point, Yitzchak knows what is happening, and they're going together. Avraham takes the Sayyid Allah, he puts them on Yitzchak, and he takes the Yitzchak, and then they work together, and then Yitzchak actually asks the question. Right? So if Yitzchak gets the first clue, he's the one who's carrying the wood. Right, and then Yitzchak actually asks, and Avraham makes it as clear as it can be, and they still walk together. But then the fascinating thing is that after it's over, they no longer walk together. And it seems to me that the development in the story is carried by the phrase Vayochu Shehem Yachdav. You have that idea that particular phrases are repeated in order to carry a theme through. That becomes powerfully evident. So now here, I want to introduce one category which I find fundamental, and the Chassidim HaSef so far should have been a useful introduction. To me, and this is my set of course on Bereshit and Maariv, I always start with Avraham section and asking this question. Is the story of Avraham a short story or a novel? And what I mean by that is that in literary context, in a short story, character is revealed, in a novel, character developed. And that's really a critical axis for understanding, right? Do we see Avraham's life as Avraham begins with perfect faith and perfect understanding of God, and the whole purpose of the test is just so that the rest of the world can see how great Avraham is, which is the purpose of some of the metaphors to Akedah, when people say, the purpose of Akedah is that the potter, the potter knocks on the stave to show other people how strong they are, right? Or is it that Abraham develops directly, that he has his understanding of God develops, his faith develops, even within that you have to question whether it develops in a straight line or whether it goes up and down. Anyway, it's a complicated axis. It seems to me that this question not only, of course, changes your understanding of the nature of the Akedah. And because if you envision the story of Avram as a short story, then Avram can't learn anything from the Akedah. Right? Whereas if you take the Akedah as a novel, then you can say that Avram is radically changed by the Akedah. There's things you have to know. Yes,
Mr.
Yes, I'm telling you up front that I am heavily biased toward the novel as opposed to the short story perspective. But I think it's very useful to understand that. Now that plays into the difference between friends, because if you have so then it can't change. Right? In order for them to change, there has to be perfection. So you have to recognize that Ramban's willingness to attribute imperfection affects the whole way in which you can read it. I have much more attraction to that. If you want to play it out in traditional Midrash, right? So the way to play this out is that when he says Vayom Rashon Avram, God speaking as opposed to God speaks to Avram first as opposed to seeing. Later on he reveals himself to God. So the question is, do you think that seeing is greater than speaking, in which case Avram develops? Or do you see that speaking is at least as greater than seeing, in which case you can never get better than Avram was capable to originally? And that you can see in the Arachayim and various other commentaries. Yes. His name changes. Again, that can be the show of the world. I have a strong bias that way. So you can recognize that there will be a lot of resistance. In standard Orthodox circles, the problem is imperfect and growing. Here's a very useful category, and instinctively people who...
Why does growth become imperfect?
If you grow that you weren't perfect before, you got better.
Your situation...
Aha, uh-huh. Okay, that's a nice way to connect it.
I don't think that's perfect.
Okay, good. I'm comfortable with that, but I think that you'll see, they'll find that that has certain, right, that is a premise that enables certain kinds of readings. And people who have different premises will not be able to read that way. But I think here's a useful, and I think that the thing is, I think this is true all through, yeah, but I think that I don't specifically. And you can say, when you look at the Akedah, you'll see that right, this is the issue at stake in whether you choose to understand the Akedah as a test, as a demonstration test, or as an educational test. Right, or as we say now, as a formative or a summative assessment. I only have two more things. One other issue is the story when Cain is upset that God favors Hevel sacrifices over his own. And here we can say, that's one way of reading it. Or you could read it as, it's on the back of the page, and this is a kind of biblical technique that we say, condition A, and you can figure out for yourself what the consequence is. The most first one says that the A is the consequence. And if you are Metis, then you get to A. And if not, the second one says, if you are Metis to A, then unstated consequence. And if you're not Metis to A, then Lepetah Chatav Rebeis. And the third way of reading it is, Alo and Metis to A, below, whether or not you're Metis to A, Well, I know the three perfectly plausible ways of reading it, and the question is whether when God speaks to human beings, he engages in deliberate ambiguity. Another example, which probably would have been a better example, is when Richter goes, to consult with looking at why there is this kicking in her stomach, she's told, and one nation will be stronger than the other. And Rabbi Avot Sa'ir can mean either the elder will serve the younger, or the elder will be the overlord of the younger. You might say that, well, God, as the perfect author, would of course always make his intentions clear to human beings, and therefore we just have to figure out which the correct reading of each of these is grammatically. But you can also know there is a phenomenon called oracular ambiguity. The Oracle of Delphi was famous for this, right? The best example of this is the king asking, should I go out to battle? The response is, if you go out to battle tomorrow, you will destroy a great kingdom. And he finds out afterwards that it's his own. One of the standard techniques of oracular ambiguity is that it says something which can be understood two ways, and it is a function of your virtue whether you understand it correctly or not. In terms of Yaakov and Esau, I believe it's Radak when you take the position and fact it wouldn't really ambiguous because it depends whether we're good or not. If we're good, we win, and if we're bad, we lose. But he says, but since it's more likely grammatically that Rabbi Avot Sa'ir and the elder shall serve the younger, so we're going to win most of the time. That's a nice solution. But again, I see deliberate ambiguity is a technique of language, right? It's the use of language for particular purposes. You have to decide if Chumash is open to those. The last category I want to talk about, and this will be sort of the key for next week, one of the really big categories that literature uses, which there's a lot of question about whether it's useful in understanding Tanakh, is the distinction between poetry and prose. The distinction between poetry and prose is very hard to sustain analytically. There's a wonderful poem in many versions by Marion Moore called Poetry, which begins with the famous first line, I too dislike it. It's set up on the page typographically as a poem, but it deliberately is written in as much like prose as you can imagine, and it writes it arguing a very staid, dry argument about how, and really if you just read it with a proper inflection, then really accounting textbooks would be poetry also. Right? So what's really going to be poetry and prose? And it's fun because you look at it and you say, wow, this is clearly not prose, this is poetry, and yet there's absolutely nothing formal you can point to about it. She enjoys playing it off as the famous line in the poetry is when you create imaginary gardens with real toads in them. Often people interpret biblical passages by focusing on the distinction between poetry and prose. I have lots of trouble with the analytic differences. On the other hand, my argument is that it is often possible, not analytically, but intuitively, to say that in specific contexts, you can see a radical shift on the scale between poetry and prose. That's the same thing, which out of context you might have argument, you might have difficulty telling whether it's poetry and prose, but in context you can say, well, that's a lot more poetic than that was, and that's a lot more prosaic than that was, and that seems to me clearly. There are clear shifts in Masto, right? Particularly in Brachos. An example I want to talk about next week is the Song of Lemma for the middle of the Beget. Alright, little X beget Y and Y beget X. And Lemma said to his wife, Adavit Tila Shmana Kalina She Lemma Tabini Mati, Kisha Rakti Likuti, the El Dechabur Si. Alright, Kisha Tain Yus and Tain Lemma, the Lemma Shibi Mashiba. All of a sudden you have, what I think it's fair to say is a poetic outburst. And I want to argue that this is a very broad thesis all through Tanakh, that the shift between poetry, between more and less poetic in Tanakh is very important, and that the ground of it is that the more poetic expression is always designed to convey a subjective perspective, whereas a narrator, whenever you have a shift between poetry and between more and less poetic, it will always be the narrator who is more prosaic and a character who is more poetic, and that this suggests that the purpose of the shift into poetry is to convey to you that we're trying to teach you something about the character in his or her perspective as opposed to about reality as such. Okay, and therefore, I would have to argue that the Song of Lamech is designed to teach us something about Lamech, and we have to ask, why is Lamech important? Such that we need to understand about him, and that will be the subject of the Shir in 2 weeks, which is going to be an attempt to respond to source criticism from a traditional perspective. Thank you, as always, guys, for listening.
The Quran was its poetic beauty, which prompted Jews at the time to, especially with talking about already 9th century, 10th century, some of the grammarians, the poets, and some of the commentators to point also to the eloquence of the Torah, not to be outdone by the Muslims, but the Torah is a proof of the divinity of the Torah. And also the elements of Hebrew itself, the language proof in the Jewish block as opposed to Arabic. So this is an early example of a set of theological arguments and theological purpose, with the assumption that something that's more beautiful is also more obviously part.
Yeah, I you're right. I should have mentioned that. Right, there is that argument. I think that it's a dangerous argument in the sense that it makes the question it raises is to make the claim. If we make the claim that Gracious has an interest in beauty, is it then necessary to say that Gracious must be the most beautiful of all books because if God is interested in beauty, then of course, right? Of course, he would be more successful at it than anybody else. That's
one of the problems. Of course, the whole argument is a very circular argument. Our standards of beauty are given to the cultural standards, so we're applying this to our general material. Where do we get the sense of beauty from? And so this is a real peculiarity. What are our definitions of beauty?
So I should have said that one of the major reasons that I have difficulty with the theological position taken by Rashi and Ibn Ezra is that there are things in the Torah that are there for art's sake. Is that it seems to me plausible that the claim that God is interested in art for art's sake would require one to make the claim that Bereshit must be the most beautiful book as for Chumash must be the most beautiful book. Now the Khazari absolutely deals with the argument that God is most beautiful book by claiming that he doesn't read Arabic, so he can't compare, and I can make the exact same claim. I have no capacity for evaluating what the Chumash is the most beautiful book. I have to, the most annoying thing about Meir Sternberg's book is that he keeps saying, God is so beautifully written, it's almost like Henry James. And I am not to be Henry James fan. I am more reminded of Mark Twain's parody. Henry James is not bad, but Mark Twain has a wonderful parody of Henry James, which is about 5 pages long in 1 sentence. And this is not my production of all authors that should be compared to Henry James strikes me as, and it depends on his having a reading of The Turn of the Screw that may or may not be compelling in The Turn of the Screw. I'm not convinced The Turn of the Screw is anywhere near as sophisticated, as engaged or sophisticated a dealing with shifting perspectives as he is. Yes.
And that the other side entirely, the anti-aesthetic argument from himself. If the Torah were a narrative, we could write a better one. But the very truth that it's not that good of a narrative is the fact that there's something else going on, and you have to be on a much deeper level that you could write a better one. Maybe I mean, that's very guaranteed. Yeah.
That's why, as I said, I put it out there to show you to be aware that Rashi and Ezra, which happens in the Bar-Ilan, I don't have the poets to make their argument. I put it out there because I think that when addressing this question, one should be aware that the Rishonim took that position. I do think that it is in, that it is a value to develop the Jewish theology of beauty, because we need to think more seriously about how we integrate art into our community. And that's the concern Chapley is being taken more seriously. Again, I'm around this piece. Although I don't know much about it, but I know that my friend David DeBoer started this program in the faith of faith and art, and I was at the moment in Israel, and I think that's a huge advance, because I used to sort of collect artists in my house and frustrated the way they found a place in orthodoxy. I hope that one planned future session of the Sarm Beit Midrash is going to be to discuss the issue of halakha and art and how we deal with questions of erotic presentations and the use of Christian, the use of Western iconography, which is heavily Christian, and how we deal with commanding against making images and all those sorts of things. So it seems to me that we really need a halakha for art that takes art seriously. And we don't yet have I'm not aware of any halakha of art that was written by somebody who cares. And if we're going to have the halakha of art, it has to be somebody who understands it. And it would be sympathetic to the position that art is valuable. So I think that's a value. With all that, I much prefer saying that Chumash uses techniques of literature because they enable it to accomplish its educational mission more effectively, and that in any case, these categories are constructed, but using these categories helps us understand Chumash better than making the making an argument on those grounds. Although I succumb to the element of prose in a really cool thing. I really think that's just amazing. All of a sudden, you know, in the middle of a culture that does nothing but write parallelistic poetry, we have a book as narrative, and you would think that the first attempt at narrative would be kind of like the first attempt at painting in perspective, right? To be very crude and take time to develop it, but in Dalladel, it's just like, it's not a long bridge, but we got Dalladel, it's never been done better. it's never been done better. Maybe there are things you sacrifice for, and not just that one little 9-6 thing, you said, look, see? See? and then went on to do something else. All right, other questions? Well, thank you.